Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we feature the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Greta Anderson.
Hi, Ursula. It's a big day today.
That's right. And today is the 4th of July.
Of course.
And today is the celebration of the sesquicentennial of Ames. Happy birthday, Ames, 150 years old all year long.
Yes. And happy birthday, USA.
And yes, I did catch the fireworks last night. I went to Ryman Gardens with my father, Klaus, and we had a brat, and we watched the fireworks. And it was a really, really beautiful event. Congratulations to the City of Ames and to Ryman Gardens for a really first-class event.
I heard there was some cake, too.
There was cake, and the line for the food was so long that people from Ryman Gardens were walking up and down the line when you were waiting for your food and giving you cake, so we got to eat our dessert first.
Oh, that's the best. Well, there's a lot more than fireworks this year.
There are musical events all day long today and tomorrow, and there'll be the Chautauqua Tent and the Bandshell Park and a lot of other events. The website is ames150.com.
And then, of course, the parade at 11 o'clock this morning had a special historical theme, and KHOI represented itself in that parade.
Yes, KHOI has a Model T, which we rode in the parade, and we were dressed in period costumes to celebrate the sesquicentennial.
And in fact, I heard that some of the young talent that we recorded for this very show were in the parade.
That's right. KHOI hosted a practice session for three young people who are performing a historical reader's theater on stage two at the intersection of Douglas and Fifth.
And recordings of those performances are coming up on our show. But first, besides July 4th, it is also just early in the month, which means it is time for our Community Service Appreciation segment from Kay Puddock.
Every month, Kay profiles a different nonprofit service organization in the community, and we run PSAs telling people how they can get involved or just letting people know about the services. This is part of our mission at KHOI as a community service. This month, Kay is featuring the Center for Creative Justice.
I've always wanted to know more about that organization.
Well, here's your chance, Greta.
My guest today is Mark Kubik from the Center for Creative Justice, which lives in a, the organization lives in a handsome red brick building on Lynn Avenue. And he's here to tell me the services they provide for our community. Welcome, Mark. I'm so glad you could come.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that creative justice makes sound financial sense for the taxpayer and for the community.
It does. To house an offender in a county jail or a prison in Iowa costs about $30,000 a year. And that cost is entirely paid by the taxpayers. A probation at the Center for Creative Justice can be handled for as little as $300 a year. That cost is entirely paid by the probationer. So if you do the math, you find out that probation is 1% the cost of incarceration. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to the taxpayers.
And it presumably makes sense in other ways. It must be very disruptive for a family to have a person, you know, an adult person in their family put in prison, often would, you know, cut off their income probably.
Probation itself has two goals. One is to help rehabilitate the offender, mm-hmm. and the other is to keep the public safe from further criminal offenses. So if you could have that person outside the jail system where they're not incarcerated, where they can be a productive
right.
member of the community instead of a burden
right.
to the community, that's a positive. It's obviously going to affect the offender themselves. It's going to affect their family. Most of our people are employed on some level, so it would affect their employment.
Right.
They're probably a member of a church. They're someone's neighbor. They're a person that lives and works right here in our community. So to have them be productive instead of being incarcerated, that's a positive, if mm-hmm. it can be done safely.
Right. And talking of safety, I believe it says on your website that these are nonviolent offenders, right?
Typically what we receive are first-time offenders and people who are determined by the court to be low risk. So we mainly handle misdemeanor-level crimes from simple misdemeanors up to aggravated. Most of our probationers are there for some type of substance abuse-related crime.
Okay. I did notice, though, that although there was this comment about nonviolent offenders, one of the typical offenders you have, kind of offenders you have, are people who've been domestic abusers, which is violent, of course.
That's an interesting topic. Because CCJ exists in Story County, nearly all of the offenders who are convicted of a domestic abuse-related crime are put on probation and they're supervised. You're not going to find that in the other 98 counties in Iowa. The Iowa Department of Corrections, Correctional Services exists, and they do a wonderful job, and they offer adult probation throughout the state. But reality is they have limited resources, so they typically only take the higher-risk clients. You'll find that across the state, in my experience and knowledge, most people who are convicted of a domestic abuse, especially a simple or serious misdemeanor, aren't supervised. They're given a jail sentence and a fine, and they're released back out the door. I think supervising that particular population of clientele is important.
Yes, I'd say so.
I think it helps ensure the victim's safety, not only during the course of probation, but in the future. One of the things that that offender would have to do would complete the batterer's education program. It's a 6-month program, and it helps the offender, helps give them the tools so that they're not going to reoffend, so that they're not going to injure someone. They have other ways to handle that situation should it occur again.
Now, what kind of statistics do you have about the effectiveness of probation regarding reoffending and so on?
Well, our big two, I would first throw out our success rate. And we've been tracking specific stats at CCJ since 2003. And we found that about 85 to 90% of our clients successfully complete probation. That's a high number.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if our goals are to help rehabilitate the person and keep the public safe from further offenses, and 85 to 90% of our clients are doing that, that's a good thing. I would also point out that accountability is a big part of the program at CCJ. Okay? They're supervised. They have to meet with their probation officer. They have to abide by all the court-ordered requirements. They also have to sign up on a probation agreement, which is about 18 rules for everyone on probation.
So it's quite a difficult process. It's quite an achievement for them to complete this.
Right. If it's a difficult process, it's because they make it one.
Oh, okay.
But if they successfully complete, then that credit goes to them as well.
Right.
Really, if you just do the things that you're supposed to do in life and make good choices, probation goes really smooth. It's when people choose to step outside those lines that things can get kind of bumpy for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we do visits in their home. We have a preliminary breath test to check for alcohol usage. We have UA kits, urinalysis, that go back in time for drug use. So coming to probation at CCJ is not a free pass by any means. They're going to be held accountable, which probably makes that success rate number even more astonishing that it's that high.
Mm-hmm.
But most people, I think, are open to change, mm-hmm. and I think it makes a lot of sense to reach that person when they are a first-time or low-risk offender instead of letting them get down the road further.
Right, right.
And then trying to achieve those same results.
Okay, so most people complete their probation, and the result of completing probation is?
We started to study recidivism back in 2007, and that is another very promising number for us. Anywhere between 87 and 90% of our clients that successfully complete probation do not go on to reoffend in that following 12-month period. That has a lot of impact. It has an impact on the offender. It has an impact on their family. It means less victimization. It means less money by the taxpayers because crime is expensive.
Right.
But any way you want to look at that number, that's pretty astonishing, that about 9 out of 10 people will not go on to reoffend. That affects the community as a whole.
Now, staying free of crime for 1 year doesn't perhaps sound like much of an achievement to a lot of people. So could you say a bit more about that, why that is an achievement?
Studies have shown that if someone's going to reoffend, it's probably going to be within the next 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that's because most people are there for some kind of a substance abuse-related crime, or they were drinking or using when they committed another offense. If they're going to fall back into that same pattern, it's probably going to be fairly quick.
Right.
And that's the window of time that we choose to track.
Okay. Are there any more statistics that you'd like to share with us?
Well, we reached a milestone last year. Part of the accountability of the court process is that everyone has to pay their fines and fees. And sometimes that includes restitution, which is money paid directly back to the victim of the crime themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, CCJ hit a milestone in that we supervised over $1 million. In court costs paid back to the state of Iowa and the victims of crime. That's a pretty astonishing number when you consider that's nearly 3 times our internal budget. So we're pretty proud to talk about
that.
Yeah,
that's terrific. So it lessens the burden of crime on the community, and it also helps rehabilitate the offenders and as you say, it makes sound financial sense. Mm-hmm. And presumably these people are on probation. They're not therefore waiting to go on trial and cluttering up the court system.
Right. This is a post-sentencing option. So they've been charged by the police, mm-hmm. and they've been found guilty by the court. And then the next step is, well, what do we do with them?
Okay.
Well, in 98 other counties in Iowa, our clients are probably going to be released out the courtroom door with a set of fines, maybe a couple of days in jail, no supervision, to the very same environment that got them there in the first place.
Okay. So in other words, these are the kind of crimes which, if you didn't have your kind of services, they would just pay a fine and that would be it.
Basically slap on the hand and released.
Yes.
And then we as a society are expecting change from that person.
Right.
Well, there's no accountability to that.
Right, right.
You know, to pay a set of fines is, for a lot of people, is very easy. To do a couple of days in jail, that's not a burden to someone. They'll schedule it on a weekend.
Right.
But to be supervised, to maintain sobriety, to our clients are also asked to do different types of programming. We should probably talk about that because that's interesting. Some of those types of programming would include a substance abuse evaluation, which is where someone meets with a substance abuse counselor, and that counselor determines what, if anything, that person would benefit from. So if that counselor feels that they would benefit from a class or a treatment program, they're required by the court to complete that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our clientele have to get mental health evaluations. Mental health is an issue in the justice system.
Sure.
Unfortunately, jails and prisons can sometimes be a revolving door to people with mental illness that don't have support and maybe aren't doing the things they're supposed to do, like take their meds. So some of our clientele are required to get a mental health evaluation where they meet with a mental health counselor. And again, that counselor determines what, if anything, they would benefit from. So if they need to be on some different meds, if they need to take some kind of a program, if they need the counseling as a group or an individual, that's something they have to complete. A drinking driver's course is required for anyone convicted of an OWI, first or second offense in Iowa. That's something we supervise that is completed. Batterers education program, we already touched on that. Parenting classes, community service, and then the court gives us the ability, or the authority, I guess, to impose any kind of additional treatment that we feel is necessary. I'll give you an example of that. If I have a client who is with me for a theft case, and he shows up, and this has actually happened, he shows up to his probation meeting with me intoxicated, I can order that client to go get that substance abuse evaluation and meet with the counselor like we talked about. The court gives us that authority because of two things. Number one, it's reasonable. And number two, it aids in the rehabilitation of the offender. So probation, you know, there's not a lot of TV shows about probation officers. Every other, you know, every police show imaginable is out there. But probation is a big part of the justice system. It's one that you just – it's kind of quiet and you don't hear a lot about, but it's very important.
Actually, pursuing that idea, I know you can't talk about personalities or anything, but do you have any interesting stories of individuals?
I'll tell one story. This is not your average CCJ case, but this is one that I had that really filled up my emotional gas tank, made me feel pretty good about the part that I played in this. I had a client that come to me, and I'm going to call him John.
Mm-hmm.
And John had been arrested several times before for alcohol-related offenses. He had been in and out of the justice system for most of his adult life. And he was there on a public intox.
How old was he at this point?
Oh, he's probably early 40s.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But when I met with John, he looked much older, which is common for people who abuse alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, Kay, when I met with him for the first time, I kind of wondered why he was sent to probation at all, not to mention probation to our agency. Here's the long story short. John went through a treatment program, an inpatient, where he went and stayed. And this, I think, was his third or fourth time to try this. For whatever reason in the world, it took.
Mm-hmm.
John also found religion and incorporated that into his life. He got a job. He maintained his own residence. He reconnected with his family, and he made it through probation successfully. That in itself is a minor miracle. The part that makes this cool for me to tell is that a couple years later, out of the blue, I'm working just an ordinary day, and the front desk in the lobby calls and said, there's a client here to see you. He wants to see you, and I figured he just had some questions or something, but that's mm-hmm. very common. So here I walk downstairs, and here's John. unannounced, in her lobby, in a suit and tie. And it took me a minute to recognize him because physically he looked really well.
Yes.
Not the same John I saw years earlier at my office. And I'm not a huggy type of guy, but I went up and I gave John a hug and I said, good to see you. I can't believe you're here. Thanks for stopping in. And here I think we're going to go into a conversation and catch up. Well, John points to somebody sitting behind me, says, son, son, come here. This is the man I told you about. This is the man that saved my life.
Oh.
John drove up here from Marion, Iowa, unannounced, in a suit and tie with his son, so his son could meet me because he had apparently told him about his experience with our agency.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And it took me a minute to kind of get my thoughts together,
sure.
But I quickly turned that back to John, and I told John, son, you know, your dad is a wonderful man. You probably know that already, but he was in a bad spot at one point, and he is responsible. He is responsible for saving his own life. I was just there to watch it. But I got to tell you, Kay, that made me feel pretty good about the services that we provide. That's obviously an extreme case, not one that happens every day.
But it makes it all worthwhile.
But when things like that happen,
yes.
You know.
That's wonderful.
Pretty amazing.
Wonderful story. Okay. So is there anything you'd like to emphasize before we close?
I got a couple of things. I'd like to talk about our history just real briefly. CCJ was founded all the way back in 1974. And our founders were visionary. And I say that because, to the best of my knowledge, we are the oldest privatized probation agency in the entire nation. If you get on the internet and start looking around, there's one out there that calls itself the oldest. They were founded in 1980. We were in 74. So our founders, who were mainly attached to the First Baptist Church in Ames, where we're housed, had a great deal of vision. They recognized that there's a gap in the criminal justice system that we've kind of discussed. Not probation services aren't offered to low-risk and first-time offenders. You usually have to have a long criminal history or commit a serious offense.
That seems backwards, doesn't it?
Well, it does to me.
Yeah.
And that's the question they asked. They asked 40 years ago, what about everybody else? Let's do something about that. And that's when CCJ was formed.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding that in 1974, our caseload was 20 people. Our caseload right now is about 750.
Wow.
So we've grown to be a big part of the justice system in Story County here. And I just want to recognize that our founders did an amazing thing. I think it's awesome because I have the best job in the entire world, and I get to be part of that today. But when you think about all the people's lives that we touched. Last year, we supervised new and continuing clients, almost 1,700 people. That's a lot of lives that are touched. And just to think that that's been around for 40 years, and it was an original idea right here by some people in Story County and Ames that made that happen, I think that's an awesome part of the story to tell as well.
That's terrific. Wonderful.
The other thing I want to talk about, too, is our funding. About two-thirds of our revenue is self-generated by people who the probationers. They have to pay their way. That's part of the accountability. So everyone has to pay a probation fee based on their income. But we can't do it alone because the other third of our revenue comes from local asset money. And asset is a combination of the city, the county, the state, and GSB, government student body,
okay.
Iowa State.
Okay.
And I think there are 30-some plus human service agencies out there that receive funding from them. We are one of them. And about one-third of our revenue is from ASSET, local funding, that helps make this happen. And I think ASSET is very proactive. So me as a director, I don't have to go to the city and the county and the state and GSB individually and ask for funding. It's done as a body. So asset.org is our website if you want to check into that more. And United Way of Story County is a big part of that, too. They're a big part of our success, too.
Okay. I've been talking to Mark Kubik, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Creative Justice, CCJ, right here in Ames. And we've been hearing about the wonderful work they do, saving the taxpayers money and rehabilitating offenders and generally helping our community. Thank you again, Mark.
Thank you, Kay. I'll come back anytime.
Okay, thanks.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, and I'm here with Ursula Rudenberg.
And we just heard an interview with Mark Kubik of the Center for Creative Justice as part of our Community Service Appreciation Program. Every month, a different nonprofit is featured here on KHOI with an interview or two conducted by Kay Patak and public service announcements telling listeners how they can connect with the organization and its mission and how to use its services.
In fact, if you are active in a nonprofit and you'd like featured on this program, contact the station. We'd love to hear from you.
Speaking of service organizations, our next guest is Diana Schmidt.
And she is very active in raising readers of Story County, and that organization is very active in our community, so that means she is active to the second power, I think. Hi, Diana.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, Diana is going to help us introduce the special feature that will be on display today and tomorrow on Stage 2, right outside our studio, really, in Ames. It's a youth readers theater highlighting the history of Ames. And this was basically her idea. She's brought it to fruition using our radio station right here at 410 Douglas Avenue as her home base. And we love it when kids come through our doors. So thank you, Diana, for involving us in this project.
Yes, thank you. Can you describe the end product and what the kids, what they're going to perform?
Certainly. Well, one of the things that I saw as a need in this community is for kids to be more involved in the sesquicentennial. And so we took three important events from Ames history that we thought would appeal to kids and the larger audience and wrote readers' theater scripts for them. So we have one about Jack Trice and one about George Washington Carver. And then we kind of fudged a little bit because I wanted to include this, the Kate Shelley story, which took place about 21 miles from Ames. But it's very important, and all of these stories are inspirational. I think they're good character models for kids, and just to think about how courageous all of these people were in their own way.
I love having the generational thing because it kind of ties the future to the past. I really love that. That's really nice.
Definitely. And I see kids as seeds. You can plant the seeds and water them and nourish them, and they will grow to beautiful flowers or crops. And sometimes kids' seeds don't get planted. And so I think this is just an example of what kids can really do when they're given empowerment.
Well, and you told me that when you were a teacher in the elementary school, mm-hmm. you would sometimes have guests impersonating historical characters.
Right. We had a project called His Storytellers. And so when I taught fifth grade history, I thought I really wanted it to come alive to the kids. So we would have different people come in and portray characters from the past. And I would say to the kids, well, tomorrow we're going to have a press conference with George Washington. And they go, what? But then George Washington wouldn't come. So this just is a little stem off from that.
Okay, well, let's listen to the kids' rendition of Jack Trice. It's a wonderful story that doesn't get told enough, I don't think.
Thank you.
My name's Remington Wilson, and I'm narrator one for Jack Trice.
My name is Wyatt Marcelle McBroom.
My name's Chastity Wilson.
The story of Jack Trice. Jack Trice was born in 1902 and grew up in Ohio. He loved playing games and sports with his friends.
At an early age, Jack learned the importance of hard work from his parents, Green and Anna Trice. Everyone respected the Trice family, and as Jack grew up, he had many friends.
Jack was happy in his hometown, but his mother worried about him. She felt his life was too easy, and so next fall, Jack moved to high school in Cleveland.
High school was a change for Jack. He no longer lived with his mother, and he no longer went to a small school.
Trice didn't know many students, and the new school had few African-American students.
Sam Williman, the football coach at the high school, became a good friend of Trice's. The coach saw that Trice was a good but shy boy. He watched over him, and he helped Trice as much as he could.
On the football team, Jack was the team's best lineman. Jack's hard work helped lead his team to many wins.
Jack's coach got a job at Iowa State University and asked Jack to come with him as a player. The move to college was hard for Jack, but Jack was not the kind of man to give up easily.
Jack gained a lot of attention during his tryouts. He was the Iowa State's first African-American athlete. Jack played hard, and he became a team leader. Jack was ready for an amazing football career.
Jack was ready to play in the year of 1923, for his first game looked like rain, and recent rains had made State Field a muddy mess. The wet field slowed the Cyclones' speedy runners. The young team also made several mistakes.
The first half was nearly over before Iowa State scored. It was a 70-yard touchdown run.
The Cyclones could not enjoy their victory for long. They had to prepare for their next game in Minnesota.
Jack thought about the next day's game. He was determined to play as hard as he could. Jack decided to write down his thoughts and place the note in his coat pocket.
The game against Minnesota would be Jack's last game, for he died of injuries at the age of 21. However, the note he left behind would keep his strong influence alive.
His letter was put on a plaque high on the wall, and when it was found many years later, students rallied for the football stadium to be named after Jack Trice. This new name became a reality in 1997.
Jack's letter and hard work kept his story alive. His note read, "The honor of my race, family, and self is at stake. Everyone is expecting me to do big things. I will."
And now, 91 years later, Jack Trice continues to inspire the Iowa State football team and the Cyclone fans.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. And we are hearing some historical readings by young people from the Ames area that are part of the Raising Readers program. Is that correct?
That's right.
And Diane, could you tell us how old are these children?
Well, we have Wyatt, who is going into fifth grade, and Chastity is going into sixth, and Remington is going into seventh grade.
Well, anyway, the Remington and Chastity and Wyatt came in the next day after we had recorded this, and they came and edited their work, and they really took right to the program, technical programs that we have to use to edit things. I barely had to instruct them. They picked it up instantly. So it's definitely the younger generation that's got their finger on these things.
Yeah, they take to technology like fish to water.
It's true. So we've got another piece to share. And this one is longer, so it may need a bit more concentration on the part of the listener. Those of you listening, perhaps you should close your eyes to imagine this scene.
But not if you're driving.
That's right. Not if you're driving. And we'll get some sound effects going. This is the story of Kate Shelley, read by Wyatt, Remington, and Chastity.
Our story begins on the afternoon of July 6, 1881, just 21 miles west of Ames, near Moingona, Iowa. 15-year-old Kate Shelley pulled the sheets from the line. A terrible storm was coming. Kate could feel it in the air.
A cold wind rose as she carried the heavy basket back to the house. Black clouds rolled in. The sky grew dark.
Kate stood at the window with her younger sisters and brother. They saw lightning flash. They heard thunder crack in the hills. Then the rain came.
As the rain poured down, they watched the water rising in Honey Creek. Soon it overflowed its banks and flooded part of the yard.
I'm going to let the animals out of the barn. If the water keeps rising, they could drown.
Be careful you don't slip in the water. Kate ran down the hill. She waded through the muddy water to the barn. She led out the two horses and shooed them off to higher ground.
She drove the cows up the hill. Then she hurried back to the barn.
She picked up some piglets and carried them to the house. By this time, she was soaked to the skin.
Kate put on dry clothes and went back to the window. The rain had not let up. The flood water was coming closer to the house.
When lightning flashed, Kate could see the shining railroad tracks. They ran along the other side of Honey Creek. Kate peered through the rain, trying to see the railroad bridge over Honey Creek. How was it holding up in the storm?
After supper, the younger children went to bed. 9-year-old May wanted to stay awake with her mother and Kate. They sat at the kitchen table talking about the dangers of the storm.
I'm worried about the men out working on the railroad.
I hope everyone stays safe.
At midnight, an express train would pass the Mongona station without stopping. It crossed the long bridge over the Des Moines River. Then it crossed the bridge over Honey Creek near Kate's house. Were the bridges safe? Shortly after 11 o'clock, Kate and her mother heard an engine chugging slowly down the tracks. The railroad men were checking the tracks and bridges before the express came through.
They were heading toward the bridge over Honey Creek. Suddenly, the engine's bell rang wildly. Then Kate heard a terrible crack. She knew at once that the bridge had broken.
Kate heard the engine hiss as it hit the cold water. She jumped to her feet.
Oh no, they've gone down Honey Creek. I must go help.
The crash woke the children. They watched silently as Kate pulled on a jacket and an old straw hat. Then she lit her father's railroad lantern.
You can't go, Kate. It's too dangerous.
I have to go. Someone may still be alive in Honey Creek, and I have to stop the Midnight Express.
Don't go. The floodwater is almost at our door.
If that were Father down there, wouldn't we want someone to help him?
You're right. Go ahead then, but be careful. We'll be praying for you.
Kate could not cross the flooded yard to get to the broken bridge. Instead, she started up a path behind her house. She would reach the tracks where they ran up the hills.
Water poured down the hillside. Kate climbed over fallen trees. Her skirt caught in wet brambles. Her shoes sank in mud.
But she held her father's lantern before her and kept going. At last, she reached the tracks.
Kate ran along the tracks back to the broken bridge. She looked out over the waters of Honey Creek. She could not see the engine or any of the crew. Had they all drowned?
Then Kate thought she heard a shout. In the roar of the storm, she was not sure. She listened again.
Yes, someone was calling.
Lightning flashed. Then Kate saw someone holding onto the branches of a treetop just above the water. Thunder boomed. As it faded, Kate heard voices calling again.
She could hear two men's voices now, but she couldn't make out their words above the howl of the storm.
Hang on! Hang on! I'll get help!
Kate swung the lantern back and forth. Now the men would know she had heard them and was going for help.
Kate began to run toward the Mongona station. There wasn't much time. She had to get to the station before midnight, before the express.
Kate ran along the tracks. Even before she reached the Des Moines River Bridge, she could hear the rush of the flood water.
She held up the lantern to light her way over the bridge. But as she did, a fierce wind blew out the lantern's small flame.
Kate stared into the darkness. To reach the Mongona station, she had to cross the river. The long wooden bridge stretched before her.
Beside the tracks was a narrow walkway. Some of its boards were missing. There was no handrail to hold.
Kate was afraid to cross this bridge, even in the daylight. Could she do it now? In the storm? In the dark?
Kate thought of the men in Honey Creek. She thought of all the people on the train speeding toward the broken bridge. She got down on her hands and knees and began to crawl across.
Kate felt for gaps in the walkway so she would not fall through. Nails and splinters cut her hands and knees and tore her skirt. She gripped the steel rail of the tracks to keep the wind from sweeping her over the side.
trees and logs in the flooded river crashed against the bridge, making it shake. Kate was shaking with fear, but she could not stop to rest. She knew it must be almost midnight. She had to reach the station before the midnight express. At last, Kate's hand touched land. She had crossed the river. The Moingona station was less than half a mile ahead. She got to her feet and began to run. Her heart pounded. Her throat ached. But through the rain, she saw the lights of the station.
Kate threw open the station house door. The men inside turned and stared. Kate's clothes were torn and muddy.
She tried to speak, but no words came out. At last, she gasped.
The engine went down in Honey Creek. Stop the express!
Then she sagged to the floor.
The girl must be crazy.
She means the bridge is out. We must stop the express.
He rushed to the telegraph and tapped out a message to Ogden, the station before Moingona. Stop express. Bridge out. Stop express.
Another man grabbed a lantern. Then he ran out to the platform. He would flag down the express if the telegraph message was too late.
The express with 200 people aboard was still speeding toward the broken bridge.
But Kate's warning had come on time. Railroad men stopped the train at Ogden. It was the last telegraph message sent or received that night.
The storm knocked out telegraph service for 40 miles along the line. Someone helped Kate to a chair.
Two men are still alive in Honey Creek. I saw them holding onto trees in the water.
Let's try to save them before they wash away.
Would you help us, Kate? Would you show us where they are?
Kate rode the engine with the rescue party. They crossed the Des Moines River on the same bridge Kate had crawled over. The engine stopped at the broken bridge on Honey Creek. Is there anyone still down there?
Help us! But there was no way to reach them from that side of the flooded creek.
Kate led the rescue party into the hills behind her house. She guided them through the woods to a bridge farther upstream.
There they crossed Honey Creek and at last rescued the two exhausted men.
Kate went home and slept for a long time. When she awoke, her family, friends, and neighbors greeted her happily. They wanted to hear about her adventure.
Reporters came. Newspapers across the country told the story of her bravery. Soon the whole nation knew about Kate Shelley. The railroad company gave Kate $100 and a lifetime pass on the railroad.
Poems and songs were written in her honor. The state of Iowa awarded her a gold medal. But of all the honors given to her, Kate liked the one from her railroad friends best.
Whenever she rode the train home, they stopped it to let her off right in the front of her house.
Do you want to hear a joke that me and Chastity did for the telegraph?
What?
Stop bridge! Espresso machine out! Stop bridge!
What do you think of that?
That was great. That was great.
I know, and the imagery is so appropriate for the season of rain that we're experiencing.
Yeah, we all know. We all know what they're talking about.
But we should make it very clear that the bridge that went over the Des Moines River that Kate Shelley crossed is not the same bridge that we spoke of at the beginning of the show.
That's right. It's not the High Trestle Bridge.
Well, that was Remington and Chastity Wilson and Wyatt Mercile McBroom. And you can see them live and in costumes this afternoon between 4:30 and 6.
Yes.
At Stage 2, right outside our station on Douglas. And they're performing again on Saturday, right?
That's correct.
In the more earlier.
Well, once in the morning and then again in the afternoon.
Okay. And
thank you for coming in, Diana. It was really fun to hear what
Thank
you're doing.
You.
And let's keep doing that. Let's bring these, you know, bring other children too, and to feature on Local Talk. It was a lot of fun.
Yes, yeah. And this is an example of a good community partnership.
Yes.
There's a lot of talent in these kids just waiting to be expressed.
And by the way, while you're out enjoying our local talent today and tomorrow, stop by our radio station at 410 Douglas, located conveniently right between Stage 1 and Stage 2 on Douglas Avenue. We will have a tent out in front of the station.
And that's where we will be selling ice cream sandwiches from a cooler and maybe distributing some souvenirs and program schedules. Ursula, I've heard you sampled the ice cream.
Don't tell anybody, Greta, but I did sample one of the, we're selling ice cream sandwiches, and they are very, very good. They actually are organic, and they are exceptionally good. So not only will you have a really good ice cream sandwich when you buy it, you'll also be supporting community radio.
Well, we've covered community service. We've covered local history. How about the 4th of July?
Well, our next story speaks to the patriotic bent of the day. We will be discussing once again an important symbol of the United States of America.
That's right. Pat Schlabarm is our correspondent for this segment, and his guest is Bob Anderson of Decorah, known for bringing us the Eagle Cam of nesting eagles live to internet viewers.
And there is news about the Decorah Eagles, and Pat's going to bring us that story.
Welcome to Local Talk with Bob Anderson. How's it going?
Morning, Pat. Just climbed out of the woods tracking down a 2004 alumni eagle.
Excellent. Yeah, so you're on the eagle path today.
All three of the birds kind of behaved really abnormal this year. When they fledged, they never returned to the tree. This is new. They've never, in all the years we've been filming bald eagle nests, this has never happened before. And we don't know if it was the huge gnat or, you know, black fly infestation or what, but the birds were of the right age to fledge, but for some reason, they just never came back to the nest tree. And then several days later, we found one in the middle of a very busy road, and I decided to, it seemed normal, but it was on the ground. And I took it home, fed it three quail, and then the following morning, we put a transmitter on it and then released it. So now every morning, I've been tracking down just to make sure that it's okay, it's fine. And then just yesterday, we had the missing eagle show up, and in fact, it's only a mile away from the nest on a very tall city of Decorah mulch pile. It's very in view from a lot of people. So now basically all birds are accounted for. We've got one with a broken wing, that Kay at Soar is working on. In fact, I think it's having surgery as we speak.
Oh, and that's Kay Newman's Saving Our Avian Resources. They're at Dedham, Iowa, rehabilitating one of the eagles from this year. Well, we'll hope for the best on that surgery.
Let me back up. Many people are always asking me, Bob, what happened to the birds from last year? Well, I mean, it was just, I would be stopped in the street. What happened to the babies from the year before? And I could never answer that question. So my longtime friend, Brett Mandernack, I met with him. I said, Brett, what do you think about if we put a satellite transmitter on one of the Decorah, Iowa eagles and see if we can answer that question? And Brett was all for it, so we ordered a very expensive satellite transmitter. And in 2011, we caught the bird I called D1 after she was on wing for about 2 weeks, and we put a satellite transmitter and turned her loose, and boy, did she give us a show. Her first year, in the summer of 2011, that summer she went up to northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota, actually at one time working way right into the Boundary Waters, where she made a quick 180 because the Boundary Waters was having a forest fire at that time. So then she returned back to Yellow Lake in northern Wisconsin and stayed there right up until late fall, where she returned home, you know, for Christmas in Decorah. And then in 2012, she absolutely surprised everybody when she set off, you know, right around the 1st of June, and went, of all places, on a direct route to Polar Bear Provincial Park on Hudson Bay, high above the tree line, and in the land of the polar bear. Now, who would have ever guessed that an Iowa eagle would do that? The following year, in 2013, D1 set off again right around the 1st of June and again went right back up to Polar Bear Provincial Park. So, and then once again, she returned, you know, to Decorah for Christmas. And And just a few weeks ago, she was lolling around Elkader, Iowa, on the Turkey River, and then all of a sudden just turned her head north, and I think within 13 days, she had covered 1,000 miles, and she's right back up in Polar Bear Provincial Park. So, you know, I'm just amazed. I'm amazed at her travels, you know, and I'm completely awed by the fact that an Iowa eagle would spend her summers so high in the Arctic. I mean, that's just it's an unknown to me. I would have never expected it.
Was there anything in the literature to give an idea that a bald eagle would migrate 1,000 miles, basically, in the rich fishing season that it would?
You know, Pat, I'm not an expert on eagles, even though I've heard Eagle Cam and a couple others. My falcons are my first love. Yeah. But I do know that there's a general tendency for eagles, if they're fledged in Florida or Georgia or down south, to come north to, like, between to Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa. So I suppose it stands to reason that our northern-tiered American birds would go further north. So this is the first time, at least that I think, that we've put a satellite transmitter on an Iowa eagle. So we're kind of following new ground and being wowed by our, you know, what she's doing.
Right. It really is nothing short of phenomenal. Are there many trees? I understand there's a lot of ice up there in Polar Bear Provincial Park.
No, it's all the photographs that I've seen of Polar Bear Provincial Park, it's treeless. In fact, Hudson Bay still has got a great deal covered in ice right now. At one time, we got a satellite reading that put her, you know, about 20 miles out into the Hudson Bay, and I think surely that's an erroneous reading. And so then I did some research to only discover that sometimes the ice doesn't come out in Hudson Bay until late July. So there is some open water, but I think a lot of Hudson Bay is still frozen. So she's out living on the ice. Probably, my friends that have been up there tell me that maybe she's living on seal kills from the polar bears, you know, leftover prey remains.
Kind of scavenging,
but
quite likely. Well, that's 3 years. What are you anticipating? Do you care to speculate where this bird, as we're fortunate that it's surviving, where's it going to nest?
Yeah. I mean, her mother nested at age 4, and when she returns this October and November, which I fully expect her to do, she will be approaching 4 years of age. So.
And how do you know how do you know it's 4? Is that from color markings? Or?
Yeah, by the head markings. A 4-year-old has mostly a white head, but still quite a few black flecks. You know, and then a 5-year-old has almost a completely white head with maybe only 1 or 2 flecks. At least that's my understanding.
Yeah, and D1 is the head is becoming whiter. So this year, I'll kind of take you back to where I interrupted. So this bird, when it returns, it's going to be in that window that its parent, its mother, was in that time frame of starting to think about nesting. We're all enamored. It's simply fantastic. Receive this new science, if you will, thanks to your research. But won't it be interesting to see where that bird ultimately nests, hopefully as a survivor?
You know, it will. I'm really hoping that she comes back and builds a nest because there's hundreds of thousands of people that love D1 and have followed her from the time she hatched to where she had her transmitter on and then all the scientific data over the years since. And then occasionally, you know, I'll track her down, I'll take a photograph of her, and the world loves that. They just love it when I find her and take a picture of her. You know, they call her the diva and all that.
Yeah.
It is absolutely incredible. It really is. We are really learning a lot. But I did want to say, we've had a kind of a, here in northeastern Iowa, we're witnessing a bit of evolution with bald eagles.
Okay.
Which is something new for me. I'm starting to find bald eagle nest sites at livestock facilities far from water. I know of 4 now within a few miles of my house, within 20 miles of my house, where the eagles themselves have built a nest directly in the yard of a livestock farm where they're feeding on, you know, probably, you know, dead aborted fetuses or dead calves or even a dead cow or whatever.
Right.
But they've learned to adapt to getting the protein from large Iowa livestock operations, which I just find absolutely phenomenal. I mean, far from water, which my whole life, bald eagles and water went hand in hand. So I think it's interesting to witness in just the last few years a change in bald eagle behavior where they're adapting so well to man, and they're finding, you know, that they can actually you know, nest right in some of the farmers' backyards and be dependent upon any of the spoils or whatever the, you know, whatever's lost in the livestock operation. In a way, I guess they could be considered, you know, almost, you know, the cleanup crew to some livestock operation.
Sure.
But that is news to me. I mean, it was just, it's kind of a recent epiphany to witness that, that we here in Iowa are seeing a change in behavior with bald eagles, that where they're no longer nesting totally over trout streams or lakes and feeding entirely on fish. They are now becoming quite accustomed to man, accustomed to our egg operations, and really saddling up with livestock operations.
Mm-hmm. And here in our local pair here along the Skunk River was dry in 2011 and 12. And our nesting pair, before the rains came in the spring, were active. I'm not certain how or where the feeding was occurring, but the river was dry. And still, they were successful in fledging young. And we did get the spring rains, but there was a point where he was, I'm not sure what he was bringing her for food in the late winter of 2012. Yeah, there's always something new, always something to appreciate, and your sharings are appreciated by, as you say, hundreds of thousands, probably millions. It's a growing enterprise. Anything else, Bob?
You know, one other thing that's kind of popped up that's quite interesting is an eagle nest just out 2 miles east of Waukon, Iowa, and it's on the Elon Road. This pair of eagles, we noticed it, we found it about 8 years ago when we were working on the nature documentary of the American Eagle, and Neil and I, we climbed the nest, and this was the very first, well, this is the second nest that we had discovered that moved it right onto a livestock facility. In this case, it's an Angus farm, huge Angus facility. And they built their nest just right on a small little group of trees not far from the main operation, and I received an email about in January saying, you know, people were aghast that they were logging all the trees around the nest tree.
Oh, sure.
And so I drove over there, and sure enough, they'd cut down about 50 trees. They left the nest tree and the tree adjacent to the nest tree standing. And I thought, well, that's going to be just too much disturbance. Surely the eagles are just going to be blown off and disturbed. But they weren't. That's the most amazing thing. I mean, that bird, these birds tolerated the removal of 50 trees right around their nest. They still continued to nest there. They pulled off young this year, and I think it's just as important to realize how capable some birds are of being disturbed near man. Now, this is a situation where the eagles move close to people, and so I think they're more tolerant of people in daily operation. Whereas I think bald eagles in northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, they just don't have that. And they don't nest close to people. We're seeing eagles now that choose to nest next to people, and they're extremely resilient to disturbance.
Very encouraging. Powerful message there.
I think in our lives, Pat, I can remember 40 years ago, if we saw an eagle and stopped a half a mile from it and slammed a car door, it took off. You know, I mean, just they had this innate fear of being shot, I think.
Yeah.
And now they're just, you know, now with less and less shootings and people becoming more and more educated, they just seem to be cozing up sometimes right to humans and in a harmonious way.
We're very fortunate that people are honoring and respecting their national symbol.
That last segment was Pat Schlarbaum interviewing Bob Anderson in Northeast Iowa about
the Decorah Eagles and the developments of the baby eagles.
That we watch on the Eagle Cam.
That's right. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and at the top of the hour we heard from Kay Patuck, who is featuring the Center for Creative Justice for the July edition of our Community Service Appreciation Program. Her guest was Mark Kubik, Executive Director of that organization.
Our next guest was Diana Schmidt of Raising Readers and Ames Reads. She presented the work of Remington and Chastity Wilson and Wyatt Merciel McBroom. Many thanks to their mothers, Catherine Merciel and Shelley Wilson, for assisting with production.
We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Greta Anderson. James Winters engineered the show.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Yes, that Kate Shelley.
You never get tired of talking about Kate Shelley here on KHOI. Another website you'll want to check out for today and tomorrow is Ames150.com. It has the schedule of all of the celebration events. That's Ames150.com.
As always, your participation as audience and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
happy 4th of July.
Happy birthday, Ames.
Happy birthday, USA.